Welcome to a podcast of the Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Mouseketeers, roll call. Count off now.
Bobby. Jared. Johnny. Sharon. Mike. Nancy. Bonnie.
From the beautiful Showcase Studios on North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, in between Andy's Deli and Lido Banquets, and just a pierogi's throw away from the Polish capital of the Western Hemisphere. It's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas, wind blowing through breathing trees, strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees. And by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. He's a legendary, charismatic megafauna in his own mind. Here he is, Mike Novak.
You know, I used to know where all the faders were here. I just, for a second there, I was confused by everything. But I am normally confused. And did you guys appreciate the Mouseketeer roll call that we have now? The official Mouseketeer roll call count off now.
Yeah.
you don't sound like you. Thank you. Yeah.
It was great.
That's Sarah. Yeah. How are you?
I'm good. A little sleepy.
On a Sunday morning at 9 a.m.?
Mm-hmm. I was up late watching Gasland.
Gasland Part 2?
No, the first one. I'm catching up.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you said that, because on our show today, we're going to have the latest and great... Oh, by the way, you need this stuff.
Thank you.
There you go. The latest documentary that will keep you awake nights, that will keep you from ever sleeping again. And that is Ed Brown's film, Unacceptable Levels, which if you're a listener to WCPT, you've heard promos for it on this radio station. It premieres in Chicago at the Museum of Contemporary Art. I have friends who are artists, and many years ago, I remember some of them used to call it the Museum of Contemptible Art, but those are just snotty artists doing that, aren't they? The ones who didn't get into the museum, basically, I think that's how that works. But the Museum of Contemporary Art is going to be showing Unacceptable Levels this Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. And it's only $12. And, you know, it's a great price to pay to never sleep again and see all the chemicals that are out there that are coursing through our veins now that we have no choice over. It's really quite a revealing film, and the filmmaker Ed Brown will be here at 10 o'clock this morning. Not in the studio. I wish he were going to be in the studio, but he is going to be on the phone and talk to us about his film, Unacceptable Levels. At 10:30, it's Tree Talk with, where's my, okay, kids, Mouseketeers, where's my bell? Where's the box with the bell?
Oh my gosh. I'm running.
No, Denny's. I saw Denny jump up over there. Looks like Denny will take care of it. Do I have to do everything around here? I'm okay. I'm fine. I was going to ding the bell, and we will have it in a second. But our great sponsor, The Care of Trees, is back. And David Horvath, who's a certified arborist, is in studio, and we will talk. Uh-oh, here we are. Bell. The Care of Trees. Oh, no! The bell broke, and the only person who knows how to fix it is Lisa, who's not here today. She claims she...
I'll work on it. Wait, I'm going to pass it up.
I know she knows how to do it. Wait, I'm going to do it the hard way. Okay, but that's not the right way. She says the thing just fits on the bottom there. That's what happens when I throw it in the box. It just gets off. We're out of control here. Yes, Lisa's not here. Rob's not here. We've got Sarah and Carol, as you heard. Our Mouseketeers. So David Horvath from The Care of Trees is going to talk about dormant pruning in the 10:30. Now, you're thinking, dormant pruning? Wait a second. We're in the middle of July. Why are we talking about dormant pruning? That's what I'd like to know. But they told me this is what we need to talk about right now. No, and the point is, I guess, preparing and planning and deciding whether you need to have dormant pruning. That's what we will do. So, David Horvath from The Care of Trees, a Davey company, will be here in the first hour. The woman who's sitting right across from me, and, I've got her book right here. In fact, I got a couple of extra copies of the book, and I think we might have to give a couple of these away today. Jeannie Nolan, who has just written From the Ground Up, A Food Grower's Education in Life, Love, and the Movement That's Changing the Nation. Now, if you go to my website, MikeNovak.net, and I hope you always do, I hope you always go to this week's show because there are links and other great information there. I hope you tweet, follow us on Twitter, at MikeNow. Jeannie, do you have a Twitter account yet?
I do.
I think, did I use your Twitter account? I don't know. No, I didn't know. So what's your Twitter handle?
Okay, it's Jay Pinsoff Nolan.
Okay.
For my personal one, and our business is capital T-O-G Gardens.
You knew this.
No, we discussed it.
Oh.
Yeah, we went over it.
Because Sarah, of course, is the Twitter gal here in the studio.
Great.
These are my peeps. Now, I know you have peeps, too, because your peeps, you actually have a publicist.
Oh.
Well, la-di frickin' da. And they wrote to me and they said, Jeannie Nolan has written this book. I'm like, I know Jeannie. I've worked with her before. We've done, you know, sat in front of people in the Good Food Festival and explained how to garden, although she knows a lot more about it than I do. I'm usually the media guy, the coordinator, the facilitator. They let me facilitate things.
Which you do so well.
Oh, thank you very much. I thought, oh, my goodness. So I got the book, and I read the book, and I'm going to tell you. And you actually have a quote. That was the other thing. I'm so naive. I am so silly. I wrote back to your publicist and I said, oh, you know, because she had sent me the proof because the book the book hadn't come out yet.
Right.
And it just July 16th was the publication date. And
congratulations.
Thank you.
I mean, this is literally your second interview?
Yes.
Media interview? I can't believe I lost out to WTTW, but that's okay. But.
Different medium here.
I know. That's why. That's why. That's why I'm looking at it. How are you doing with that bell? See?
Not so good.
Lisa. Lisa, where are you? You're the only one who can fix the bell. I don't know why she's the only one who can fix the bell.
She must have little fingers.
No, she has an engineer's mind. That's the difference. Right? So I wrote to your publicist, and they sent me the galley, and it had all these blurbs on it that you sent out. And I said, oh, you know, Jeannie should have sent me a copy.
You're absolutely right.
I'd have written a blurb. No. And then I looked, I went, oh, my God. Bill Curtis, Art Smith, Bill Shore, Rick Bayless. I went, she didn't need me. Okay. She had... Wow, you sure got a who's who on there.
Thank you.
Good stuff.
Good people.
And you got the intro, the foreword. Oh, my gosh, Alice Waters.
Yes.
Wrote the foreword.
Very kind of her.
A lot of people have been nice to you, huh?
Yes, I agree. A lot.
At some point this show, we got to figure out how to give away a couple of books. I tend to get myself in trouble with these contests because I refuse. It's like I do garden talks. I bring magazines, Chicagoland Gardening magazines, and if you ask me for a magazine, just say, can I have a magazine? You will not get one. I do not like begging, okay? If you answer a question, you know, I'll put these questions out about gardening and horticulture and environment. And if you can answer a question, I'll give you a magazine. And that's the way I do it on my show. But, you know, a lot of people just go, oh, we'll take the fifth caller and we'll give you the book. I was like, no. I want people to earn it. All right?
I'm not just giving
stuff away. So we got to come up with a question.
Question.
Yeah, I would say, it could come out of the back of the book. One of the things you have to know about this, the appendix is worth the price of the book alone. It's 10 lists, and this is in Jeannie Nolan's book, From the Ground Up, just released. And the publisher is...
Random House.
It is? Well, but they have...
And the division is Spiegel & Grau.
They're
amazing.
It's Spiegel & Grau.
Yeah, two women who really publish books to make a difference in the world.
Really?
That's their specific
and is
focus.
That, okay. Well,
within
we'll have,
Random House.
In a second, we'll get to that. But the appendix is 10 lists of 10 essentials for every aspiring gardener. The appendix alone is worth the price of the book. So the first list is 10 reasons to grow a food garden, which include health, taste, safety, exercise, focus, budget, climate, community, happiness, nature.
Was exercise on that list?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's like number one. Yeah, health, you know. Although you've got it separate from exercise, mm-hmm. but it is kind of separate from it. Second list, how to grow a food garden in 10 steps. You hammer that a lot, and one of the things you hammer, and I'm so glad you do, because it seems so simple, and yet people don't get it, and you illustrate that in your book, sunlight.
Right.
I don't know why people don't understand the concept of sunlight. It's, you know, you have a couple of instances in your book where you write about people say, oh, I want the vegetable garden right there. And it's under a couple of trees. And you say, not so much. That's not so much going to work. No. That's where the vegetable garden is going to go. And I don't know why people don't understand the concept of sun.
I think people don't really realize how much sun it takes to grow food.
Yeah, I think you're right. Anyway, and then the lists like 10 ways to tackle weeds and pests without chemicals. Maybe we ought to do a question on that. You got sluggo on here. I love the fact that you have sluggo.
Well, they make an organic sluggo and it works.
Yeah.
So?
It's, they're iron phosphate and slugs eat them and they stop eating. They don't want to eat anymore and then they die. although I have to tell you something. I don't understand why. And I grow hostas. I don't have like waves of hosta. I've never had a problem with slugs, ever.
That's interesting because I find I probably this season am at over 100 gardens that we tend, and some of them get slugs and some don't. You know, I think it's very site specific.
Yeah. Then you've got 10 easy to grow vegetables for the novice gardener. You've got the favorite gardening products, 10 favorite gardening products, 10 tips and resources for gardeners with kids, 10 heroes to follow. My name's not on it.
I'm sorry, Mike.
I'm not sure why.
Oversight. due to an oversight.
Can I be number 11?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
You are number 11.
Thank
You're there.
You.
You're the write-in candidate.
10 books, magazines, and websites to read. 10 organizations to support. I'm glad you've got that in there. 10 ways to be part of the sustainable food movement. It's just cool stuff.
Thank you.
All right,
yeah,
so,
those were really fun to write, that aspect
they were.
Of the book.
All right. But when you pick up the book, and I think Bill Curtis in his blurb, alludes to this, that it's surprising. It's not the book you expect. Okay, and we'll get into the gardening aspect, but the really interesting aspect is how you draw people into this. It's a story about your life. And I'm going to say that, like Bill Curtis, I was surprised. But I was surprised that you would put yourself out there that far. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, well, let's talk about that a little bit. Because
sure.
You're like some way it's kind of like mine. Mine's not as extreme as yours, but how I got here is a very circuitous route. You know, there's no straight lines anywhere in my life to anything.
Right.
And it sounds kind of the same with you. And the point was that, you know, right out of high school, you ditched your family, went to live in a commune, which turned out to be a cult, and you were there for 17 years. The good news is you learned as much about organic gardening as anybody could possibly learn, which set you up, and we'll talk about that in a second, set you up when you came back. The bad news is they were a very destructive influence, and you write about that honestly. And the thing that amazes me is that after 17 years, you still have – there's love and sympathy for those people there. How do you reconcile that?
Right. I mean, you know, my husband who lived on the commune as well, and I've been talking about it, and we coined a term last night. He said, well, it was a cult, but like there's Coke and Diet Coke, there's cult and diet cult. So you know, there was a lot of good about it, but there was enough bad. You know, it wasn't physical harm. It was psychological kind of gamesmanship.
Yeah,
stuff.
But that is very harmful.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
That is abuse. You suffered 17 years of abuse, and your husband not quite as long.
Yeah.
But there you, and that's where you guys met.
Right.
And that story is in there.
Yes,
so I'm not going to
tell. There's a love story.
No, there's a love story. I mean, it's so amazing. I run off to a cult, and there's a love story, and then there's. All this stuff, and I'm looking at this. I thought this was a gardening book.
Right. Well, you know, for a while I considered writing a how-to gardening book.
I'll bet you did.
But, you know, when I knew I could condense it into 10 lists, and there's so many great gardening books out there, I decided to tell my story, my personal story, because I hoped and thought that there was enough in it that was universal that would resonate with people about their lives and would make the impact of the message about the power of the seed-to-table movement, the power of growing your own food, get that message to more people,
mm-hmm.
To people who are gardeners, but also to people who want to read a book and feel like they got dirt under their fingernails but maybe won't garden. But this would get
and
the
that's
message
what, it's
to
one
them.
Of the things I like about that is that, again— a lot of people who read this are going to have some sympathy and empathy and relate to you in that here you were after 17 years of working in these fields, completely organic conditions. You come back to Chicago and you're still unsure you know exactly what you're doing. And people want you to garden for them. You go, I don't really know how to do that here. I mean, I did it in North Carolina, and I did it in Texas and in California. But Chicago's really different. And I'm thinking, no, really, not so much, no. But that, you know, trying to find yourself after all this. And I think that relates to that whole 17 years there and how they managed to break you down.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of that operation.
Absolutely. I mean, and it really was. And that's kind of the story, really, in a nutshell, is that I, as you said, I ditched my family. I went far away from everybody who loved me and the community where I grew up to, quote, find myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was ultimately when I came home and put a garden in my backyard that I found the purpose and meaning and realized, oh, I can change the world right here at home.
Well, silly me. Why did
exactly.
I think of that 17 years ago?
Exactly.
But you know, a lot of people go out to find themselves but don't disappear for 17 years.
Right. Absolutely.
And it's a credit to your family that they kept trying.
Oh, yeah.
And they just said, okay, we'll keep working this. I mean,
yeah.
And they would come and visit you and you know, to all the hostility that was on this commune.
Absolutely. And they just never gave up and never stopped loving me. And it's a real parenting lesson. And when I was ready to come home, I knew I could because they had never turned their backs on me.
Mm-hmm. So you think you're getting a gardening book, and you are getting a gardening book, because one of the things you do throughout this is you talk as you're telling your story, and it's a fascinating story. You talk about gardening along the way and the things you learned. Now, okay, I'm going to stop right there and talk. We still don't have a question to give away, because I'm going to get, you know, I may end up doing fifth caller. You know, that may happen here. But I still want to give away a couple of these books. Anybody have any inspiration there? Well, I suppose it should be
we
you.
We could ask somebody what's their best crop this year in their garden. Something like that.
We could.
Are you looking for something more exciting than that, Mike?
I'm looking for something a little more challenging, that where they actually have to research or something.
Okay,
I mean, if we
okay.
took one of your...
what's the best tool to use to plant a leek? Something like
wow.
that.
See, now that's a little too arcane.
Okay.
I
went too
perfect.
Severe on you.
What would you use to plant a leek?
A dibbler, of course.
Oh, what was I thinking?
What were you thinking?
I've got one right back here.
You've got to get that leek down deep in that soil. Only a dibbler will do. Sorry.
Okay. Well, that's not the question. Because we've given it away. Do you know how long we did one of these. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago where we did this? No, it was last week.
Okay.
Lori Lewis was here from the Sheffield Garden Walk. And by the way, they're having, wow, they got good weather. And the Dearborn Garden Walk is today, too. And we had a totally unscientific observation about what people grow in Chicago, down in the Sheffield neighborhood and the Gold Coast and so forth. What was the most popular plant that unscientifically we had seen? And I have judge gardens there, and Lori works there a lot. And we couldn't get people to guess it. And it turned out our answer was boxwood.
Okay.
We see like boxwood forever.
Right.
And we got every answer, but it was just amazing. So that's a dibbler. I think in about 3 weeks we would have gotten a phone call with the right. But that's along that line. That's what I'm thinking to give away the book.
Okay.
All right. So keep that in mind.
Yes.
But I do want to get to something that some of the stuff you talk about. One of the things you mentioned when you were on this commune and putting together organic fertilizers. And do you still use the same thing now, or a similar type of fertilizer? And you talked about putting together some sort of slow-release granular fertilizer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How do you do that organically?
Well, you know, at the time when I farmed, we would always be very specific. So we would test the soil because I farmed in these different regions, And then we would, through a soil analysis, figure out which soil amendments we were going to use, gypsum or lime or colloidal rock phosphate.
And did you find when you went from California to Texas to North Carolina, was it North Carolina?
Mm-hmm, yeah, North Carolina, outside of Asheville.
Were you dealing with different pHs?
And yeah.
Because what folks fail to understand is that in one pH regime, you're going to use lime, and another it's going to be gypsum.
Right. And I mean, North Carolina was the most extreme. Like blueberries and sweet potatoes did super well there.
Mm-hmm.
Because
the soil was very acidic.
Exactly.
How low was the pH, do you know?
I actually don't recall off the top of my head.
Okay.
I don't.
I'm asking you questions nobody else is going to ask you. I'm telling you right now.
Right.
You're not going to get these.
And then when I got, back home to the Chicago area, what I did at first was I bought bags, little bags, five-pound bags of kelp meal and bone meal and blood meal and dehydrated manure, and I mixed them together. But then, you know, as the grow-your-own-food movement is gaining so much momentum, it is now very easy to buy a pre-mixed, well-balanced, certified organic bag of fertilizer for vegetables. And that's what I do. And I've had great luck with
that. That's a really good point. Is that these things have changed.
The times have totally changed. This is so much more mainstream. I mean, you walk into Whole Foods and there's a whole section, grow your own food, you know.
Yeah. And you know, there are people like Dr. Earth advertises
exactly.
on my show.
And his products are great.
They're wonderful.
I really love his products so that, you know, we often use that product.
And I think that's a good thing that folks can get the kind of fertilizer that will do the job organically. And they don't have to mess around trying to pull everything because it's very difficult.
Right. And I mean, I think. You know, the whole thing of testing your soil, not for lead, but, you know, to find out the pH and the nutrients needed. Some people who are scientific do that, and that's fantastic. But I don't do that here in Chicago. I add compost and granulated fertilizer to every soil, and it grows great.
Yeah, well, you know, and you do talk about lead in there.
That's another story.
Yeah, and my yard, I did the test, and it was through the roof.
Me too, when we lived in Evanston, and that's in the book. I mean, it was just...
Yeah. And that happens, and that's why we always say if you're going to be gardening in the city or the suburbs,
mm-hmm.
even in exurban areas, you never know what was there.
Absolutely.
50 years ago, a factory or a business or something. You really should test for lead and other, not just lead, but other.
And I have found lead mostly next to old homes that were previously painted with lead paint.
Well, like my 125-year-old home that is just, oh my gosh, it's so high. All right, I need to break, but we're talking to Jeannie Nolan, who's written a book called From the Ground Up, A Food Grower's Education in Life, Love, and the Movement That's Changing the Nation. We still haven't figured out how we're going to give away a couple of these books. So while we do this, I want you to put your thinking cap on. Sarah, you help her.
Okay, we'll think of something.
We have a suggestion from a Twitter follower.
All right, what's that?
So it's DJZ324 suggests asking for the class of pesticides that's killing bees.
Well, there's a couple. I'll take one of two answers. How'd that, all right? And I think you know which both of those are. Okay. Give us 773-763-9278. And that's actually a really good question because in the book you also talk about, and I quote some of this on my website, you talk about the pesticides we use and how they're harming us and that's going to come up in the second hour with Ed Brown in his new film, how we don't really know. And the controls are useless. The so-called controls, I'm using controls in air quotes here. As a matter of fact, this is a quote from your book. It's a stunning fact that roughly 40 known carcinogens are currently used as ingredients in EPA-approved pesticides. Moreover, on average, 18 new pesticides are submitted to the EPA for approval each year. The approval process hinges on a disturbing cost-benefit analysis. The agency greenlights new chemicals if it decides that the benefits of their crop and economic yield outweigh the potential costs to health and the environment. It's a balancing scale, kids. If the money's enough, it outweighs the health risks. Anyway, and you write about stuff like that. So, yes, 773-763-9278. Name one of the two major chemical group, chemical...
pesticide.
Pesticides, but they're groups, mm-hmm. not a specific pesticide, that have been killing our bees. How about that? 773-763-9278. We'll be right back with Jeannie Nolan.
My name is Peggy, and I publish Chicago's only local magazine that provides the latest news and trends about healthful living, including alternative and complementary medicine, fitness, good food and drink, healthy kids and families, and even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings is free and available each month throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Christy Weber Farm and Garden Center has a couple of words for you. The first is perennials. Their Perennial of the Week program is off and running, and it means that right now you can pick up coneflower, black-eyed Susan, echinacea, also known as, wait, that is coneflower. Why did they say, wait, coneflower, okay, ornamental grasses, Russian sage, and specials too at great prices. Okay, that's more than one perennial, but hey, take advantage of it. The other word is mulch. This is the time of year to get your plant beds, trees, and shrubs mulched to keep in the moisture and deter pests. Christy Weber is currently offering a buy five bags, get one free deal. Cedar, hardwood, ultrafine hardwood, black sable, red mulch, pine bark nuggets, and cocoa bean mulch are currently in stock. How about one more word? Stone. And you can pick up some of that wonderful stone that Christy Weber has gotten her hands on at Christy Weber Farm and Garden Center. Or maybe you're considering having some landscaping done. The hardworking crews in the familiar red trucks at Christy Weber Landscapes are known for the individual care and attention given to each job. Log on to ChristyWeber.com and like Christy Weber Landscapes Farm and Garden Center on Facebook. And by the way, Christy Weber is a proud sponsor of the Sheffield Garden Walk and Music Festival in its second day today, and the weather is going to be perfect.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I want your green, natural health or wellness business to be part of the leading sustainability resource in the country. Each month, Natural Awakenings Chicago is packed with information our readers use to find the products and services they need to live happier, healthier lives. Natural Awakenings is free each month throughout the city and suburbs and online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Gardeners are a funny lot. They're always looking for answers. You know, their favorite flowering shrub collapses in a heap, and they want to know why. Go figure. Well, if you need to know every little nitpicky detail about why your dumb plant died, I mean, if you're a serious gardener who expects results, then you need a subscription to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. Every issue, Adele Klein's Q&A column handles the tough questions that keep gardeners awake at night. For instance, the July-August issue poses the questions of whether perennials go dormant during droughts and whether you can cut them back to conserve water. Somebody actually wrote that and said, I want to cut back my perennials because it's really dry. Is that a good idea? The answer is get out the watering can. Here's a classic, though. Which vine can be trained on a chain link fence? The answer is, why do you still have a chain link fence? And there's my column on the inside back page. There are no questions, and there are certainly no answers about that. Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, get a subscription. Go to chicagolandgardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600.
Looking for a housing investment that can pay big dividends? Remodel your kitchen or bathroom. You'll freshen up your home and add value to it, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling needs. Kitchens, bathrooms, master suites, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
I get no time.
It occurs to me that this is kind of your theme song, Jeannie. You know,
it's a good one.
Yeah, it sort of applies to what happened to you. Jeannie Nolan is the author of From the Ground Up, but we should also tell people that, you know, if you're a fan of local food in Chicago, you should know about some of the work that Jeannie has been involved in, like the Edible Gardens. And that was one of the first things that happened when you came back from your 17-year sabbatical.
Yes, it was.
Tell me how that happened.
Well, I was very fortunate to be introduced to a woman some Chicagoans will certainly know of. Her name was Abby Mandel. She's no longer alive, but she was the founder of Green City Market. And I was hired to help her run the market. And then she got the great idea, once she knew my organic farming background, to start an edible education program in Lincoln Park Zoo. And it's now entering, we're in our ninth season there. We have 5,000 square feet of organic vegetables growing in the farm in the zoo. It's a partnership between Green City Market and Lincoln Park Zoo. And it's open to the public Wednesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays. Kids take field trips, and we have adult workshops, one free workshop a month on Saturdays I teach. And it's a great place for Chicagoans to learn where their food comes from.
Are you still real hands-on there?
I am. I mean, I also have a great team that runs it with me.
Yeah.
And they're awesome.
Because you have this business, the Organic Gardener Limited, again, which came out of everything that you had done before, and you started from nothing and putting up flyers and hoping people would sign up. And you, what, I have over 200 clients now?
Yeah, we're busy bees. We help families, schools, nonprofits, restaurants in the city and in the suburbs grow food. You know, our most recent project is we put a food garden in at Old Orchard Shopping Mall. So, you know, anyone or anywhere they want to grow food, we
I know, and that's the point that you've pointed out, that you've shown people you can grow food just about anywhere.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of reasons to do it. And so it's very exciting.
Yeah. And of course, Jeannie is also involved. You helped put the Uncommon Ground Restaurant first organic rooftop farm.
Absolutely.
Together.
Yeah.
And I love Helen and Michael. They've been on the show a number of times.
I love them too. And we have a great event for the book there on July 28th, Sunday evening.
Oh, well,
yeah.
Plug it. That's
absolutely.
Next week.
Absolutely. It is. And there's going to be a rooftop tour. Helen, the owner of the restaurant, is going to give a tour of the rooftop farm. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to speak about my book and do a Q&A. Plus, there's a great dinner. So it's Sunday, July 28th from 4 to 7. And probably the easiest way to get tickets is to go to my website, which is theorganicgardener.net, and go to appearances. And
okay.
It's the link to buy tickets for the event is there, but it's going to be a fun one.
Theorganicgardener.net.
Mm-hmm.
And link to what?
Appearances.
Okay.
And then you'll see
and that's
all the
next
upcoming
Sunday.
Uh-huh.
What time is that?
4 o'clock.
4 p.m. at Uncommon Ground Restaurant. That's on 1401 West Devon,
good
I believe.
Good memory.
I
yes.
know. I don't know how I pulled that out of somewhere.
Yes, but, well done.
Great. That's
yeah, it'll be a fun event.
Any others that are coming up?
Mm-hmm. So Friday night, I'm speaking and doing a book signing at the Bookseller.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's 7 o'clock
yeah.
in the city here. So those are the next two book events coming up.
All right. And I'm sure there's going to be many more.
Oh, there
and,
are.
And keep me posted as we do this. All right.
Great,
let's take a couple of phone calls trying to give away from the ground up food growers education in life, love. And the movement that's changing the nation. Let's go to Joe on line one. Joe, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hi, everybody. How are you?
All right.
It's neonicotinoids, isn't it?
Where's my bell?
Ding, ding.
Ding, ding, ding. Yeah, that's one of the things. That's it's just one of the pesticide groups that have been discovered that have been implicated in bee loss. We do know that they affect bees, products like imidacloprid and several of the others. I had a list of them up on actually on my website a couple of weeks ago, and if you go to past shows, you can see that. How do you know this, Joe?
Well, I'm an herbalist. I live in northwest Indiana, and this is one of my pet peeves. This spring, we had very few honeybees out here, and that kind of scared me, so I started educating myself, and I read about this.
Hmm. Where'd you write about it?
No, I read about it.
Oh, read about it. I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you said write. Okay. Oh, we had one, a person drop off the line but who also guessed correctly. But, okay, here's what I'm going to do. Joe, I'm going to put you on hold, and you talk to Carol and get your information to her, and we'll send you a copy of the book.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for listening to the show, and thanks for calling in.
All right.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Dan on line two. Dan, you're on, on the Mike Novak Show.
I think I heard the question wrong, and I was thinking of glycophosphates, and I'm not sure if that's involved with bees. But I just another thing that is involved with bees that I've been reading about is the communication systems have been screwed up by cell phone towers around the world. So that's not a chemical group I know, too.
Well, you know, it's interesting. On August 11th, I'm going to have May Barenbaum on the show. She's from University of Illinois. She's an entomologist, and I have interviewed her before, and she knows a lot about this. I think she will probably tell you that the cell phone towers have nothing to do with it. She at one point said it was in a talk she did, which was hilarious. She said, "There's as much to the cell phone towers have as much to do with bees disappearing as the bee rapture does." Okay, so but. That doesn't mean that there aren't other things going on. And I'll tell you, you're close enough. Yeah, I was looking for organophosphates, okay? You kind of conflated the names there, but I'm going to give you the other copy of the book. Organophosphates have been around longer than neonicotinoids, and they originally were causing harm to our insects, and we've scaled back on the use of those, and so we decided let's come up with something just as dangerous. And, you know, we'll talk to Ed Brown about that in the second hour when he comes in to talk about his film. So hang on a second.
Mike?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say two quick things. One is a follow-up to last week. When you toured, when there was the tour of the BP plant on the southeast side.
Yeah.
A great resource is Stuart Smith, stuartsmith.com. He's the lawyer who made the largest environmental suit against big oil and gas ever, $1.6 billion, specifically against BP. And he's got all kinds of news, including the absolute proof that radon, radium, uranium is in the fracking pools. And that it is impossible to separate out these standing pools. It gets into the air, it's breathed, and it gets into the food supply because they're putting it on sludge, which is going to the big agri farms, and you're eating it. So it's not just an environmental toxin.
Mm-hmm.
Stuart Smith is a great resource, and also recommend the dangersoffracking.com. It's an animated short that gives you all of the numbers and the scale of this horrible process. It's from the makers of Gasland Part 1 and 2.
And I'm glad you're saying that as well, because I'm also lining up a show that we're going to show segment we're going to devote to fracking. So when May Barenbaum comes on August 11th, we're going to talk about the whole bee issue, I want to ask her some questions about where we're going with this, her speaking as an entomologist at the University of Illinois. So, all right, great,
okay.
great sites. Thank you so much. I'm going to put you on hold. I hope that works. There we go. And we're going to get him the book. We did it. We gave
great.
Away the book.
Yay! Wonderful.
I would ding the bell, except it doesn't work. Jeannie, thank you so much. It's way too fast. You know, you and I could sit and wax poetic about gardening. But I want to thank you for writing the book, and thank you for coming down here today. And you got
to
come back. I mean, this is the first time. And what we'll do, I tell you what we'll do. Why don't we, when you've done with your grand tour,
wonderful,
come back to the show And we'll just answer gardening questions.
Great. That would be fun.
Well, you
know, I'd love to do that.
Talk about organic gardening and just answer questions. Tell me real quickly this year, because I got to get just one quick perspective. What have you seen in the garden, in the vegetable garden, that people need to be aware of? What's caught your eye? Mm-hmm.
We had a little bit of germination issues in the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
Cucumbers, edamame a bit, you know, with the cool weather didn't quite come up. So we just replanted.
Yeah.
Ran into that. Cabbage loopers are out there for sure. And the brassicas on the broccoli and cabbage, doing a lot of hand picking of them, getting those green guys off of there. And, you know, just being aware now, the heat's kicking in, watching your watering.
Last week I was out in our community garden and just doing extra watering, you know.
And at the same time.
And watching the cabbage butterflies land on the cabbages and go, oh, wow, we're going to have cabbage loopers here. Okay.
But so far, I think it's been a great season. I'm really pleased. The spring greens were just lovely.
Oh, wonderful.
It was really, very bountiful.
Yeah.
And so we're hoping for a good tomato year. Last year wasn't so good that way.
Glad to hear you say that, because people...
At least for us, it certainly wasn't, and a lot of people
I know. And you know what you're doing, so there you go.
Yeah, tough tomato year last year. So far, so good.
All right, well, Jeannie Nolan, pick up her book, From the Ground Up, A Food Grower's Education in Life, Love, and the Movement That's Changing the Nation. It is published again. What was the imprint there? It's
Spiegel and Grau,
New York. And
it's on Amazon. It's easy to find.
And I put the link to your website, because I always like to sell through people's websites than Amazon.
I like
Why give Amazon all the money?
I like that.
All right. Thank you. We'll talk again real soon.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Here's a tip from the... Don't turn off your own mic. Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. Last week, I talked about a little about why you should start planning for dormant pruning of your trees. One reason is that people tend to use their yards more extensively during the summer months. A large-scale pruning operation can require a great deal of equipment. During the winter months, people are inside, and the noise associated with pruning operations is not as bothersome. Another reason is that pruning during the dormant season can minimize the risk of disease spread via pruning cuts. For example, in areas where oak wilt is common, pruning oaks during the winter can minimize the spread of the disease. Now, I'll be talking about dormant pruning next hour. And again, we're in July. We're going to talk about why we're talking about it now, if you can follow that. Arborist David Horvath will be in the studio. In the meantime, if you want more information, talk to a certified arborist at the Care of Trees. Call 800-508-9466, 800-508-9466 for a free consultation. If you call on Sunday, leave a message and your call will be returned on Monday. Guaranteed. 800-508-9466 or go to thecareoftrees.com. The Care of Trees is a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees.
Is pain keeping you from enjoying gardening? Dr. Bonnie Flaster at River North Wellness Center has gentle and effective techniques to get you out of pain and back to doing what you love. Here are two quick tips. First, remember to stretch. Second, use a timer to make sure you take breaks. Come see her at River North Wellness Center and find more tips at rivernorthwellness.com or call 312-642-7545 to make an appointment with Dr. Flaster and get back to feeling good.
And in honor of Sarah Bacca.
Thank you.
Who's a huge Stones fan. I had to play that. I've got a few more in the mix that we'll be doing. Let us go to Ricky D on line. You're on line four today, Ricky D.
I love line four.
And you're back in town.
And I'm back in town. I haven't been on line four. Although I was on line two twice. I guess that's the same as line four, right?
No, they're different. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
I'm back in town. It feels great to be back.
And you were out in Colorado and discovering some interesting weather phenomena, or at least observing stuff. You know, what is it you come away with after your vacation in Colorado?
Well, the first thing, Mike, is the weather pattern. You know, basically, coast to coast has been one of extreme variability. We've used that word many times before. Variability meaning that the way that the upper air pattern has been developing has basically been moving a lot of the weather kind of in a reverse direction, almost from east to west across the southern section of the United States, such that they've got into their what's called their summer monsoon season across parts of West Texas, New Mexico, into Colorado and the Arizona, southern Utah area. Almost about a month ahead of time, and with that, you know, the return to a lot of afternoon shower and thunderstorm activity, and also flooding rain. So part of the reason why I found the trip so interesting, I was actually in the Boulder area for a couple of days, in the Breckenridge, Summit County area. That's the area that's basically the highest part of Colorado. Average elevation is almost 8,000 feet. And you know, it was only about a couple of weeks ago that they were, you know, fighting that terrible wildfire just to the west of Colorado Springs, and it was just after that that they had that tragedy down in the Prescott, Arizona area, obviously fighting the wildfires down there. So, obviously, you know, when you get into these mountainous areas where their weather is pretty much seasonal, you have these dry periods, you have these wet periods, and you have basically people living within nature, where here in Chicago, we have people living basically within an urban environment, and you have buildings and houses and, you know, streets and highways all around you, whereas you go out west, that pretty much ends about a block or two away from your house if you live in a rural area, and you are surrounded by nature. So you basically have to live with it a lot more, and what they're dealing with out there is the seasonal differences that they've noticed between precipitation and dryness and heat, and obviously the disease that's called the pine beetle that's been devastating the trees out there. Their wildfire season now, Mike, is almost 30 to 40 days longer in some areas, and you have to worry about waking up in the morning and looking out your window and worrying about whether or not your neighborhood's going to be there tomorrow. And we don't live with that in the Chicago area. So it's a much, much different environment out there compared to what it is here, and also compared to what it was even 10 to 15 years ago.
When you talk about the fire season longer, and that's a combination of everything, is it the heat and the dryness and the devastation that the pine bark beetle has done, all of that?
It's all of that, and it's also the fact that things have become so much more variable that where you get dry longer. Where you get hot longer. And the seasons have pretty much not only shifted, but even what we saw here, you know, your previous guest was talking about how, you know, yeah, we were cooler, but we had more spring greens, and you were talking about that as well. So it's not so much fighting climate change or climate variability, but it's really learning how to adapt to it. I think that's the key thing that you know, we keep learning about it. And what was interesting was I was out there, and I really feel bad about this, but the next day I read in the local paper, they issue these papers daily out there. It's basically free, with a lot of money obviously paid by advertisers to make it free. But there was someone who was actually talking about what they're doing to mitigate the upcoming concern about the fire season. Even though they've had a lot of rain in parts of northern Colorado, their worst part of the year, believe it or not, is at the end of the summer, late August, September into October. And even though it's raining out right now, don't think that our fire season is not something that we have to be concerned about. And you keep having more and more people move into these areas further and further away from what used to be these towns. You have these people living basically 5, 6, 7, 8 miles out. You cut a road through through what was a, you know, say an access road, and you put a couple of houses there. And next thing you know, people go, wow, that's cool. There's houses there. I want to live there as well. And now you have a small community of 10 homes. And this is actually stressing And also stretching the issue of how to fight fires where you used to just let it burn, now you have to worry about fighting it. So
right.
This is a huge, huge concern to, you know, not only Colorado, but also New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, and then you get up into the other states as well. So it's just a different way of living within the community, the environment, obviously the climate as well.
And, you know, here in the Midwest, we don't deal with this a lot. As you mentioned, our lives are very different. And certainly up here around Chicago, we don't have forests, the same kind of forests. But this will become an issue about clearing out the forest, forest management. We have these issues periodic, these discussions periodically. And the problem with them is that, when you have a fire like the fires like these that are so devastating, then you get the people who take advantage of it and come in and say, well, I guess we got to cut down those trees, you know, because they're getting in the way. And it, you know, and their idea of, and I'm using air quotes again, managing a forest is a way to exploit a forest. And, we'll have to figure out how to walk that balance, that thin line there. So these are the conversations we're going to start having again. We got about a minute here, yeah. Rick. So yeah, what about here in Chicago?
It has finally cooled off a little bit. I know yesterday was the first step to cooling down a little bit. We got it up to 89 degrees. So far, 6 days above 90 this year. Compare that to 32 last year. Still temperatures averaging about 2 degrees above normal. So the bottom line, comfortable day today. Temperatures generally upper 70s, lower 80s. Pretty much mid-80s for the rest of the week, Mike, with a day-to-day threat of a couple of isolated showers or thunderstorms beginning tomorrow. But overall, nothing in the way of any 90-degree weather coming at us anytime soon. And you can really say goodbye to the extensive heat and humidity we had around here over the last 4 or 5 days. So a return to more summer weather. And finally, Lake Michigan is swimmable with temperatures along the shoreline, generally in the upper 60s, Mike.
So are you getting out there in the kayak?
I will get out there in the kayak as soon as I get my laundry done today.
Okay. Always a pleasure to hear from you. Welcome home. And we'll talk to you next week, Rick.
Sounds good, Mike. Take care. Bye.
You too. Second hour, we're going to be talking about Unacceptable Levels, a new documentary that is coming out. It's going to have its Chicago premiere at the Museum of Contemporary Art this Wednesday. The filmmaker Ed Brown is with us, and of course Tree Talk with the Care of Trees will happen at 10:30. So feel free to call in with your tree care questions, and I hope you stick around for both of those things.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees. And by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
We've got Ed Brown coming up on the show in just a second, but I wanted to catch up with what's going on here. Of course, Carol Brewer in the studio today and Sarah Batka. How you guys doing? Don't everybody answer at once, okay?
I'm good.
I just wanted to get a Facebook and Twitter report here. What's going on in Facebook? I haven't even looked at Facebook this morning.
People are liking things. They're
well. That's good.
They're checking it out. They're checking jeans.
You know, should I do my usual begging for likes on the Mike Novak Show page?
Well, I met a new follower, Lynn Hasselberger, here in Chicago.
Oh, Lynn! Lynn is the one who helped me get Ed booked on the show.
Okay.
So
great.
I'm glad that she's.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks for your help.
Sorry, just hitting my password here.
We are up to 947, so yeah.
Oh, that's where we were.
Well, that's where we are.
Nothing's changed today. Come on.
Well, Mike, I think that you haven't yet mentioned your dinner that you're hosting at Angelic Organics Learning Center. That's coming up.
Yeah. I am going to be the MC. at their event, which is on the 4th of August. Let's see, Grow Connect. The website is www.learngrowconnect.org, and it is Angelic Organics Learning Center, and it's out in Caledonia, and it's their peak harvest farm dinner, and I hosted it last year, and surprisingly enough, they asked me to come back.
It features celebrity chefs from.
Yeah, they have this dinner and it's under this big tent and it's right next to the farm, which is really cool. So you get to see the farm. You have these wonderful meals, and a chance to support the institution there. And, Chef Paul Virant of V and Perennial Virant. And Chris Pandel of the Bristol and Belena. And, I'm not going to pronounce any of these names right. Paul Farabach of Big Jones. Jason Hamill of Lula Cafe. Lula is right in my neighborhood. Scott Manley of Table, Donkey, and Stick. Johnny Anderis of Reno and Telegraph. And featuring beer and cocktails by New Holland Brewery and cocktails by Koval. And it's just a wonderful way to spend an evening. I even come out on a Saturday. You know me. I don't do Saturdays because I'm usually doing prep for the show. But this is a great event. And if you want more information, go to learngrowconnect.org, which is Angelic Organics Learning Center, and / farm dinner. And I hope you guys all show up. I hope a bunch of people come out and support the organization because it's really, really very, very worthwhile. All right, let us go to the phone. Let's bring in Ed Brown. Ed, good morning. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Mike. I'm great. How about you?
All right, where are you today?
Unfortunately, I'm in central Pennsylvania at the moment. I only say that because the humidity here is... It's taking over. It's taking on a presence of its own at this point. So the temperature has been really dramatically different over the course of the past week as it has the rest of the summer.
You will
other
be,
than that, we're great.
Yeah, you will begin to grow moss on your head.
Well, that's a good thing because I don't have much hair left. So that's going to be an improvement, I think.
I hope that some of our weather comes your way, because today in Chicago is a perfect summer day. We got rid of all that nasty heat and humidity, and we're going to be in like the low 80s. And my meteorologist Rick DeMaio said earlier, just a few minutes ago, that mid 80s all week. So
that's fabulous.
Yeah. So I'm
headed your way, so that's a good thing.
That is a good thing, because you'll be here on Wednesday at the Museum of Contemporary Art for the Chicago premiere of Unacceptable Levels, which is your documentary. When did you actually complete that?
About 20 minutes ago. it wasn't that dramatic, but... It actually wasn't very long ago. It's been a tinkering process for 4 years. I would say that principal photography ended about a year and a half ago, but we've still been messing around with it for another year and a half. So
yeah,
we're just getting done with it now. So the Chicago screening is really important because this is the first time everybody will see the final print.
Ah, because I saw it online. I saw a version of it online. And, yeah, I noticed a lot of stuff in there, video clips that were relatively recent, which is good because, I mean, you have kind of the standard fare. You know, it's interesting. There's sort of a shorthand now for doing an environmental film. And part of that shorthand is you go back through the files and you look for all those old chemical ads and propaganda pieces from the 50s and 60s that are grainy, and they speak of the wonders of using chemicals, and let's, you know, get everybody on board. And those are part of the whole, like I said, shorthand of doing a documentary. But they're effective because, you know, you see those videos and films, actually, sometimes kinescopes, I would imagine.
Yeah, right.
Of you know, the kids trailing the trucks as they spray. But, you know, things have changed somewhat. The difference being now they still spray. They just don't let kids run behind the truck, right?
Well, yeah, what you're talking about are the DDT sprayers that kids used to run behind. And they used to, what I understand, they used to get coated in a film that kind of felt like a translucent, like plastic, and it coated them, and they all thought it was really fun. And of course, I'd hardly imagine something that could be worse for your health.
You know, I have to jump in for a second. The guy who started Gardens Alive was on my show years ago, and he said that when he was a teenager and a kid, they used to spray 2,4-D in the in Indiana along the ditches there to kill the weeds. And they would just it would be a hot day, and the cooling mist of the DD, he can 2,4-D rather, not DDT, but 2,4-D. He could feel the cooling mist of the 2,4-D on his skin. And you think, oh my God, what were you doing to yourself at that point?
Hard to imagine something like that, huh?
Yeah. But that's what your film is all about. How did you decide that you had to, you used to do sports, and were you a producer, sports producer?
No, it feels like a lifetime ago, but no, I was the lead highlight writer for the NFL Today and NCAA college football and basketball on CBS Sports.
Okay, tell us a little about what does a highlight writer do exactly? I mean, did you work with the clips and then fit the commentary to the clips? How does that work?
Yeah, I used to joke about it because I used to think, like, what, there were just a bunch of monkeys sitting behind a television screen, you know, putting something together for the halftime and postgame show, but it's actually human beings that were working on it, and there were a number of us in a number of different cubicles, and what I did was I waited for the best clips in a particular segment of a game that was happening, and then the director would choose what clips were going to go up, and then I'd have to frantically write something that was legible and understandable and so that the guys could read on air whenever it went up live.
And how long did you have to get that to them?
Yeah, usually it was about 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought, yeah.
Yeah, for 50 minutes. Another thing that we always liked was that about for 50 minutes every hour, we wouldn't really do much of anything except for just hang out and talk and screw around. But then there was the frantic 10 minutes that right before he went up on air, and then that was always a really stressful part of the day. Yeah.
Yeah, I imagine it is. So how does one go from writing sports highlights to traveling the country and talking to people about the chemicals that are used every day in so many different ways and that we are affected by?
You know, I never really wanted to be a documentary filmmaker. I always wanted to be a filmmaker. It just happened to get my break in entertainment and on television. But I never really was even around a camera until after I was out of college, and then I thought to myself after I moved out of New York City that I wanted to go make a film, and I was a failed stand-up comic. I wasn't very good at it, but I tried it a lot of times.
Welcome to the club.
I tried it all over the East Coast, any club that I could get into. Usually it was just an open mic night, but sometimes I opened for a couple people that were on HBO or Evening at the Improv and stuff like that. That's back whenever they were still doing that stuff on TV. And I'm not even aware if they are anymore. But so I always wanted to be a filmmaker, and I always wanted to make comedies. So I moved to back to Pennsylvania to make a film, and it actually was the worst disaster I could have ever imagined. My life took a really different turn because I lost all of my money. I lost all of my my credibility and tell it well, because I made a film that wasn't a film. I didn't even know what I was doing at that point because I never took a class in filmmaking or anything like that. So over the course of 10 years, I started waiting tables and building myself back up just to get my credit back in line, number one, and number two, so that so I could learn how to actually become a filmmaker without actually going to film school, is a trial and error process, and that's what I went through. I made a couple of short films, and I taught myself how to edit. I taught myself how to write and to direct and to shoot. And so then I met my future wife, Lauren. We were working at the same restaurant together, and we started dating, and you know, we fell in love very quickly, and she got pregnant, and then she lost the baby, and then we were really upset and stuff like that, and this is something that could take its toll on someone, you know, for a little while, and it did, and I started to think back to a glass of water that I had in that same restaurant we were working in that tasted like a lot of chemicals. And I thought it was just an odd thing that, you know, if it tastes like a swimming pool water, which is what I felt like I was drinking, and we're supposed to drink 8 glasses of those a day, I thought, I wonder what 8 glasses of chlorine or chlorinated water would do to me. And then I forgot about it. I really didn't think anything about it anymore. And then we had our son, and his name is Braden, and he's 5 years old now. But whenever he was one, we decided we wanted to try again, and we had gotten pregnant again, and then she had a very early miscarriage just about at the end of her first trimester, and that was really difficult as well. And it was at that point whenever I decided, you know, what's going on here? I don't know what's happening. Is it something that's chemically going on inside of her body? Maybe it's just nature. And as the doctors had explained, and nobody knows why this happens, but usually it's the body responding to something that's not going correctly. And I was thinking, well, maybe the body's not responding to something correctly because of the chemicals that might be inside of her and other women's bodies. And that's whenever I started to use my journalistic, my writing abilities, and also my research abilities. And then that's when I took my film skills that I learned on my own. And then that's when I decided to create a documentary film about what is essentially a problem that affects every single living organism on this planet.
Did you ever find out what happened?
No.
So you had 2 children and 2 miscarriages.
That's
right?
Correct, yeah.
Wow.
Well, we had our daughter after the second miscarriage, and her name is Maya. She's 3 now.
Yeah. And you never did get any satisfactory explanation for that?
No, we didn't, and there's a good reason why we didn't, because with 200 to 400 that we know of, 200 to 400 synthetic industrial chemicals inside of our bodies right now, you know, the law, the court system in the United States has a term that's ubiquitous. It means that you could be affected by any one of those, so it's very difficult to tell which one of it was the culprit, if that was the culprit at all, and so that's where the mystery really lies, and that's why this film is designed the way that it is.
Well, right, yeah,
you know,
and not only that, as you point this out in the film as well, it's a matter of not just those 200 to 400 chemicals, but how they interact with each other. And nobody measures that. No, there are no studies about how chemicals interact. When they do these material safety data sheets, it's about the one chemical, not how it interacts with the other chemicals. And that is part of the problem here. We don't know.
You're absolutely right. If we could imagine our bodies are very similar to a petri dish in a way, just, you know, metaphorically speaking and figuratively speaking, whenever we look at ourselves, it's very difficult for us to gauge. We can usually know what perhaps one chemical in parts per billion could do in our bodies at a low dose exposure. Maybe they could gauge that. But whenever you combine that with all these other chemicals we're interacting with daily, and then our own body's ability to either get rid of the toxin or it's going to be stored in our body somewhere, that's really where we have absolutely zero idea of what any of these things could be doing to us. So that's where the precautionary principle plays in.
Yeah, and the precautionary principle, of course, is that that what we need to do is put the onus on the manufacturers to prove that their products are safe rather than the onus on the public to prove that they're harmful. But we don't do that in America. We flip that totally on its head. We throw the products out there and then 10 years later go, oh, maybe that wasn't such a good idea.
That's an absolute fact. And this goes back to the first point you were making about using the vintage clips that I had shown throughout the film. Doctors, you remember there was some famous ads that doctors were endorsing cigarettes. And I find that to be, you know, it's shocking and almost laughable today to think that any doctor, of course, no one of any reputation would ever say something like that today. But knowing that that's the stance and the mentality that they used to have. And, you know, I guess the most difficult aspect of what we're dealing with whenever it comes to chemicals is that these do come onto the market, and it takes 10 to 20, 30 years or 40 years of exposure to make a determination that maybe this was the wrong idea to put the stuff out there. A great example is PFOA, which is one of the backbone chemicals of Teflon, which is being phased out completely in 2015, but yet it was on the market for 35 years. And freely being used, and of course PFOA is in every single living organism on this planet right now, and that to me is a shocking statistic.
Every single living organism?
This is a chemical that travels, it migrates. I mean, they found it in dolphins, they find it in seals, they find it in polar bears. And you say, well, how could that happen? I mean, it's not like they're cooking on Teflon. You know, up in the Arctic, these polar bears are going to be eating the seals and stuff like that. But that's just how dangerous a chemical like this is, and that's why it's getting phased out.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know.
Yeah, and a number of chemicals, as we know, we phase them out, but then we bring in new ones. Something that Jeannie wrote about in her book, and she was on in the first hour, Jeannie Nolan, who's written a book called From the Ground Up. And one of the things that she said that 18 new pesticides are submitted to the EPA for approval each year. And that's just pesticides. That doesn't even, you know, that's not even the stuff that you're talking about. You're looking at everything, what we put into our clothes, into our food, into our building supplies, all of that stuff. That's what you're trying to address, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I think it'd be naive for any of us to sit back and think one chemical, despite it being very, very bad for you, like BPA, for instance, one chemical that we all know is bad, it's a hormone disruptor, it's going to be screwing with your body, and it messes with the kids especially and the elderly and people with compromised immune systems. My point is, if I point a finger at one chemical and I made a film all about that one chemical, first of all, it wouldn't really get the point across. Because this is in every chemical, every moment, every environment exposure. So if I put on cotton clothing, if I'm going to be, you know, wearing sunscreen underneath that cotton clothing, if I'm going to be eating food that has pesticides in it, or drinking water that has fluoride in it, or using shampoo that has a surfactant in it, you know, these are all things that we're being exposed to on a constant, every second basis, and that's why. That's really the big point, the breadth of this, the massive impact that we've had in our chemical addiction in this country isn't just about what goes into our gas tanks. It's about what goes into us as well.
We're talking to Ed Brown, who is the filmmaker who created Unacceptable Levels, which will be having its Chicago premiere this Wednesday at the Museum of Contemporary Art. You can go to unacceptablelevels.com or go to my website, mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show. All the information is there. You talk to a lot of people, Ed, you know, scientists, educators, Ralph Nader, Randy Hayes from the Rainforest Action Network, Jeffrey Hollander from Seventh Generation. Who surprised you the most? And this is kind of out of the blue, and I hope I'm not sandbagging you here with this, but what?
No. I mean, there were a lot of people that surprised me, but I don't think any of them really blew me away the way John Stauber did, who is the author of Toxic Sludge is Good for You. It was serendipity whenever I had it, this off chance to meet him because I was interviewing at another play or another individual, and that's what I had set it up for. And then she invited, it was Lisa Jacobs, But she invited in John Starver, and I was just blown away because I was doing the interview and I didn't even have a chair to sit on. I was on my knees filming him. And what I learned about sewage sludge, which is the American sewage system, the waste products is the product that is collected, and it is a product that's sold or given away for free. But learning about sewage sludge was really something that that just really, if I had hair, it would be blown back, and I was really, really shocked by what I was learning about that.
You know, that's actually a good point because you address this in the film, and it's something that I've talked about on this show. Here's my point of view on that. We create, oh my goodness, you know, all this sludge that the waste material, and we have, as you point out in the film, it's not just that, is that we combine it with pharmaceuticals and we combine it with oils, petroleum products, and it all goes into water, and then somehow we have to try to remediate the water. It turns out we used to dump that in the ocean. That was what we did with it. But if it is so dangerous and we do need to clean this up, my question is, what do we do with it? You know, the answer obviously would be not to make those chemicals, but in the meantime, we're stuck with that. So how do you propose addressing the sludge problem?
Well, in the interim, I mean, it's going to be that seems like a monumental task, obviously. I think that there's no question that if we, and here's my point, if we choose to do the same thing and continue doing it for the next 100 years or 200 years or 400 years with this stuff, what is our land going to look like? And so we have to make some concerted efforts, not just to sway the EPA to change their stance on what they deem biosolids, but also to understand that these are things that nobody ever anticipated going into this, into sewage sludge, like radioactive waste or DDT, PCBs, all heavy metals, mercury, and stuff like that. Nobody ever anticipated that happening. So my point is that we have to do a much better job of wrangling them in the first place to try to eliminate these types of things going into our wastewater supplies at all. And that's really the only way you eliminate it is by eliminating it. But this is going to be a very slow 40 to 50 year process at best, I would imagine.
I think we're not paying enough attention to it. It's just one of those issues that obviously we have to figure out what to do with this stuff.
Yeah.
And there are companies, that are out there doing it, and addressing the heavy metals problems, addressing the pharmaceutical problems, and trying to come up with products that are not as toxic as obviously as the raw sludge. And it's really very a difficult thing. You also talk about, and we just have a couple more minutes here, fluoride as being one of the biggest boondoggles in the history of the planet.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Sure. I mean, we've been doing this for over 80 years now, fluoridating water. And I think it's interesting that I was one of those individuals as well who I bought the sales pitch that if I drink this water, it's going to help my teeth. But then whenever the analogy was given to me that drinking fluoride to help your teeth is kind of like drinking sunscreen to keep the UV rays away from your skin. It's not like fluoride just goes straight to your teeth. This goes into your entire body. And to know that the fluoride that's going into our municipal water supplies isn't sodium fluoride, which is a pharmaceutical-grade sodium fluoride, it's actually a different product which comes from the phosphate fertilizer industry, which is hydrofluorosilicic acid, which is hydrogen. There's a number of different acids that are used to get the. It's done mostly down in the state of Florida, but to get the phosphorus out of this rock, they have to use acids to melt the other minerals around it to get it off of it to get this precious phosphate for fertilizer, and. So in that process, they have to spray water onto it, and then they sit back and say, well, what are we supposed to do with this stuff? It's extremely toxic. It's very it's a volatile chemical. It'll melt glass. And so we've decided, well, there's nothing else we can do with it. Well, I guess we'll just put it into the water supply and call it fluoride. And then everybody was just going to be hunky-dory with this. I find that to be a staggering way of handling a waste byproduct, but that's exactly what happens at most of our municipal water facilities across the entire country.
That was the thing that stunned me. And, you know, we all know about fluoride, but now it makes me want to research this a little more. And as you say, basically it was there were no questions asked and there was no debate. It just happened. And suddenly we all have fluoride in our water.
Yeah. And that's the way it happens often. Whenever it comes to something this big, scientific theory, scientific approach, people wanting to have an intelligent conversation about how to handle something like this. There's backdoor deals that happen, and there's also a lot of quiet deliberation that goes on that we won't ever know about, and how these things get pushed through like this is it baffles the mind in a democracy like ours. But it is the reality that we live in, unfortunately. But knowing that we all have the capacity to do something about this is really what makes me excited. It makes me feel good about how we can get rid of just something like fluoride or sewage sludge or something, or any of the other products that we're working on right now to try to help to eliminate for the long run for all of our health.
Yeah. You said the word democracy, and in some ways you look at a film like what you've put together and you say, really not so much, not much of a democracy anymore. And you see the things happening around you. And I got to admit, I really don't buy that line anymore. I think it's run by money and it's run by influence. And every now and then somebody yells out and they look at them funny and say, well, what are you yelling about? And then they smack them down and then they go on with whatever else they're doing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cynical, but it's frustrating. You know, the other thing is that I have been talking about you almost stole my line because for
right.
but that's okay, because for years in Garden Talks I've been saying, you know, I've been talking about acceptable levels and what the EPA deems acceptable in terms of pesticides, mostly because that's generally what I deal with in the horticultural realm, and they'll say this is an acceptable level, and you know of 2,4-D in your lawn care product, and I will say, well, what's your acceptable level? Mine is zero, or your tolerance level, whatever. Mine's zero. I don't know about you, but I don't want this stuff in there, and I'm not going to stand for it in my yard. But a lot of people don't even pay attention. So, I'm the kind of guy that reads the MSDS sheets, and I'm the kind of guy that reads Grist, and I'm the kind of guy that goes to Beyond Pesticides. But I'm not the normal guy. So I'm thinking that the people who see your movie, Ed, are going to have their eyes opened. I'm hoping it does some good.
Well, I appreciate that, Mike, and I'm with you about democracy. It has its challenges. There's no question of that. And I'm certainly with you about every point you've made. And I sit back and I think, if we have a chance to look down at our children, how many levels of pesticides would we say is acceptable inside of them? Or how many levels of fluoride, or how many levels of DDT or PCBs or anything else, even these legacy chemicals, which I keep bringing up because they're still around and they're still getting into us. But there's also a lot of modern ones like sodium lauryl sulfate or, MSG and stuff like that. How many levels do we find is acceptable that our kids can tolerate? And that's really the big question I'm trying to pose to everybody, so we can all, you know, ask those questions intelligently, know more about it, and then go about our business and try to make the world a better place together, because this isn't just a Democrat issue. This isn't a Republican issue. This isn't an independent issue. This is an every person issue. And we really want to get that across to everybody as much as we can.
Yeah. We have got a, before I let you go, I have got a question from Dan, and I hope you can address that. Dan, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to mention the thing that seems to be the legal, the
the way that the change about and knowledge about these chemicals is blocked, and that's a legal principle used by legislatures and courts called GRAS, which stands for Generally Regarded as Safe. And that's the reason why we got GMOs in, because people have all, they said, well, people have always grafted plants onto each other, which is genetic manipulation. And having no knowledge and no studies that they admitted to of the process of actually using gene transfers in genetically modified, or a totally different science. The same thing happens with the fluoride, because there was this little pool, there was this natural lake that had supposedly some higher fluoride, and the kids had less cavities in that town, and it was completely anecdotal, but it was thought to be, well, generally accepted as safe. And the same thing with fracking. Fracking, I've talked to the top gas and oil lawyers, and they always come down to, well, people have always pulled gas and oil out of the ground, and completely overriding the fact that fracking currently uses 72 trillion gallons of water filled with the worst toxins known to man. I mean, we're creating one Superfund site over the whole state of Illinois now.
Well, and over much of the country as well. Ed, had you heard about that?
About which aspect? The fluoridation in the lake?
No. What was that? The
principle is generally regarded as safe.
Oh, and grass, of course. Yeah, of course.
Jeff Smith wrote about that a lot in his books, you know, Genetic Roulette and so forth.
Yeah.
Deception. He came to that. And in fact, there were 70,000 documents at that time in the EPA, which were being covered up, that said they were not safe. But the lawyers and the mentality was to use grass.
Interesting. Dan, thank you. Great comment. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, Dan.
Ed, yeah, so you encountered that in on the way as well.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, that's something that's commonplace in our court system, in our government, because in the event, it's a litigious environment we live in. I mean, so exposure is the operating word. So exposure that we are going to be subjected to, meaning how much are we, you know, in the most general sense, how much of the chemical could we be exposed to? And then we also have the other side of the coin, where the companies and their level of exposure, in the event that somebody gets sick, how could they prove that, and what's their out-of-court settlement or their in-court settlement, or if any kind of settlement's going to happen, what's that going to look like? So exposure is a word that we really need to concentrate on. What are we exposed to? What are the insurance companies and the companies themselves exposed to? So whenever you have grass, or generally regarded as safe, and coming into play here, that's where the court system is almost always going to back the companies and the insurance companies that are covering them whenever it comes to something like this, because it's so difficult for us, if we do get sick, to track something that's going to be a dangerous chemical that we know is toxic, or that we feel strongly is toxic, that there are signs that are pointing that it's toxic, for us to, and general is just a general term anyway. So for us to make a real assertion and a real assumption about how to deal with something like that, meaning we're going to lose if we go into a courtroom and try to present our case that way. So that's really what we're looking at when it comes to every single chemical that's on the market today. Generally regarded as safe is, to me, is a ridiculous notion, but we've accepted because we have an economy to grow, and chemicals are the biggest part of our entire economy for the past 120 years.
Mm. Well, that's Ed Brown. He is a filmmaker, and his documentary, Unacceptable Levels, premieres. If you want to see it, it's at the Museum of Contemporary Art this Wednesday, 7:30. Tickets are $12. Now, if you want to spend a little more money, you're going to have Mariel Hemingway there at 6:30, and you and she are going to answer questions, right, Ed?
Absolutely. It's going to be a great time, and we hope to get as many people there as possible. Marielle is a close friend of mine, and she's been a tremendous voice in this movement of just trying to get people healthy and understand that chemicals play a big part in that. So we would love it to see as many people there as possible, because we'd love to meet you and take some questions from you. Of course, provide some answers to you as well.
Well, Ed, I hope a lot of people show up. You can go to unacceptablelevels.com or go to my website, mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show, and I've got all the information there. Ed, a pleasure having you on the show, and congratulations on your film.
Thank you, Mike. The pleasure is all mine, buddy.
I hope we get to, I'm not going to be able to be there on Wednesday, unfortunately. I'm booked already, but I hope we get to meet at some point.
Oh, I've got my fingers crossed already. Someday, hopefully, we'll make that happen.
All right. Take care.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk AM and FM. We're talking trees in just a second. If you love farmers markets, but if you don't have the time to get to one of those as often as you'd like, I have an alternative for you. How about getting a CSA share? CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. Now, you might think it's too late, but there's still time to sign up, and you can even get your order prorated for the season. Where? Well, at Purple Leaf Farms, run by a friend of the Mike Novak Show, Jessica Rinks. She has started her own local sustainable business in suburban Elgin, and she grows vegetables, herbs, and cut flowers using organic methods, no synthetic chemicals that you just heard about. Herbicides, pesticides, or synthetic fertilizers. If you have a Purple Leaf Farms CSA, you will get a weekly supply of fresh, local, and pesticide-free food for the rest of the summer and early fall. The option includes full and half shares, and in either case, you get fresh-cut flowers and at least two kinds of herbs. There are locations in Elgin, the pickup locations, Elgin Forest Park, Oak Park, Heinz VA Hospital, and the UIC Chicago campus. Shares run through late October. Know your farmer. Go to purpleleaffarms.com or call 312-437-7542. 312-437-7542.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Summer has arrived, and for many gardeners, that means heat, drought, and watering bans. Help your landscapes thrive despite these seasonal challenges with proper care and Milorganite fertilizer. Hi, I'm gardening expert Melinda Myers. Mulch the soil with a layer of organic material to conserve moisture, reduce weeds, and improve the soil as it breaks down. Water plants thoroughly and less frequently whenever you irrigate the garden. This encourages deep roots, making your plants more drought tolerant and pest resistant. Water early in the day to reduce water loss to evaporate. And be sure to use Milorganite for all your summer fertilization needs. The organic nitrogen is slow release and won't burn plants even during drought. Milorganite remains in the soil until the conditions are right for plant growth, including your lawn, so there's no need to water it in. Plus, the 4% non-staining iron promotes deep green growth. So choose Milorganite for better results naturally. Visit Milorganite.com for a garden center near you. That's Milorganite.com.
Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I got you. Wow! I feel nice.
It's the Mike Novak Show, and we all feel good here. Some of us more than others. And, I am happy to welcome into the studio David Horvath from The Care of Trees, Davey Company, a great sponsor of the Mike Novak Show. How are you, David?
Oh, I'm wonderful, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Thank you.
It's a great day, isn't it? What a beautiful day.
Beautiful out, especially compared to last week.
I know. About time.
Yeah.
You guys, when you're out there climbing trees and stuff, it gets pretty sticky and nasty, doesn't
it? It's grueling for the guys out there being in the trees. You know, they probably go close to a gallon of water a day out there.
Wow.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you to pull that mic just a little. You can pull that up. It's all right. There you go. There you go. Get a little closer to that. And as I've been mentioning on the show, as leading up to this today, the idea here today is to talk about dormant pruning. Now, I'm looking outside, and I'm seeing leaves, and they're not even turning color yet. They're green. It's the middle of the summer. Why are we talking dormant pruning right now, David?
Sure. Like, you know, most people out there, it's the furthest thing from your mind. But from my standpoint, it's time for you to start thinking about that in preparation for winter, on us getting out there looking or evaluating your trees to prune them this winter. In particular, in a lot of the communities, there are ordinances that regulate which trees can be pruned during particular times of the season.
They have specific, and it's because of spreading disease and insects?
Correct, absolutely. So the two particular trees that I think a lot of people are familiar with in the area would be elm trees, such as American elm, and our oak trees. Very critical that we wait till winter to prune those trees in regards to the health of them.
Uh-huh. How do you know if your tree is a candidate for this?
So probably the best measure to take is to call a certified arborist, such as the Care of Trees, invite that arborist out to your property and evaluate, have it evaluated, kind of a tour of your landscape. See if you have those particular trees on your property and what makes sense to have performed in the winter months.
Mm-hmm. You guys do that for free, right? You'll come out and do a free consultation.
Correct. All the consultations are complimentary.
Yeah. All right. I had a question here. And by the way, if folks are listening and they got a tree care. Oh, look at this. This is exactly what I'm looking for. I told her that. Let's go to line one. And I told Arlene, she wrote me an email and said she had a tree care question and she wanted to talk to you, David.
Wonderful.
I said, give us a call. And anybody else, 773-763-9278. Arlene, good morning. I'm so glad you called.
Good morning.
Good morning,
now,
Arlene.
My problem, I have an ash tree on my property. And I know it's dying, but is it dying from emerald ash? And when should it be cut down? Do I wait for winter? Should it be cut down like yesterday? And what happens to the wood once it gets cut down?
Very good questions, Arlene.
And of course, when she said emerald ash, she meant emerald ash borer, which is the insect that is devastating ash trees. And didn't you, something you said in your email to me is that...
Right.
In your...
I drove around the neighborhood,
yeah,
and almost every ash tree in the neighborhood is either dead or dying.
Where do you live, Arlene?
I'm in unincorporated Glenview.
Okay.
So, Arlene, one of the things as an arborist that we evaluate when we're looking at ash trees is how much of that canopy is without leaves. Kind of a rule of thumb, if it's 40% dead or, you know, 40% without leaves, that tree probably should be taken down at this point. Because ash trees, as they die, they become very brittle. And those limbs can fall out and pose a potential hazard to items located beneath them. If the tree appears to be very much alive, then it might be a good candidate to have that done in winter. Especially if it's located above perennials or annual flowers, that we really want to minimize any kind of damage to your landscape when we take that tree down.
Right.
And as far as disposal of the wood, Arlene, many of the areas are under quarantine. So the wood doesn't leave the area, but it does get chipped up and hauled away on site. So that's something that you don't have to worry about.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that I you know, Sean Kingsett.
Yes.
Who's a buddy of mine and who's worked at the Care of Trees and now Davey for a long time. You know, he's pretty fatalistic about trees that already show damage.
Sure.
He says once you start to see decline in a tree, it's probably too late to do much about it. And do you feel the same way about ash trees?
I do. You know, the only time I change that mindset is if it's a tree that's very critical and important to the customer, and the customer is willing to kind of take a gamble on, let's try a course of a treatment. If the tree responds, then we've saved that tree. Mm-hmm. If it's a tree that's just in the backwoods, then I would probably say, yeah, let's let nature take its course. When it's time to take it down, we'll take that tree down for you.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that you're dealing with, Arlene, is that those trees are probably, a lot of them are goners. And there's not really not a lot to do once you can see that damage. Now, I was looking at some other things online. I don't know if you mentioned that ashes also have other problems, too.
They do.
That, and that's part of the problem. Now, unfortunately, if emerald ash borer has been discovered in your neighborhood, chances are that's what the tree is suffering from. But there are other kinds of ash problems as well.
There are, yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm not worried about having a tree cut down. I think it needs to be cut down.
Okay.
My concern is when should it be cut down, especially if it is emerald ash borer, mm-hmm. you know, so I should wait until winter when it's dormant.
If that tree still looks like it, you know, and has a lot of leaves in the canopy and looks just kind of sick, I think winter mm-hmm. would be a great time, especially, like I say, if it is located above plantings in your yard.
Yeah, it is. It's above the driveway and you know. So I'll just hang in, and I may call you out before then and say, let's set up a date then.
That's a great idea, and then we can evaluate that situation, make sure that you're not at risk for anything possibly going wrong prior to winter. Let us make that decision if it makes sense to take that tree down now versus waiting.
Yeah.
I understand.
It's good to have those folks out there to help you out with your decision. Arlene, I'm so glad you called. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And, of course, one of the reasons you know, there are a number of reasons for coming out in the winter. And you can see if you're just doing pruning, mm-hmm. it's one thing. Cutting down a tree, well, a lot of the same things apply. For instance, the idea that the other plants in the area are dormant. Sometimes the ground is frozen. That makes it easier. So you're not having the truck, or the equipment, heavy equipment, compact the soil.
Correct.
That's great stuff. What other reasons might you want to come out there? Visible branching.
Visible branch patterns. We don't have the leaves obscuring our view. So if we want to enhance the branch pattern of a tree or enhance the form of that tree, that's a really good time to do that.
Because let's face it, you know, a lot of folks, they see the leaves, they really don't know what the tree looks like.
And it's amazing how much deadwood is hidden in a tree with all those leaves masking.
Yeah. All right. You get them going. The calls
Fantastic.
Start coming. And let's go to Jack. Jack, you're on the Mike Novak Show with David Horvath.
How you doing?
Good, right, Jack.
I was told I had spider mites on my arborvitaes. Is there a way I can get rid of those? I really don't want to do it the chemical way, but. That's what I was told, or maybe there's some things I can look for to see if what I'm being told is the truth.
Sure. One of the best ways, the reason the spider mites are typically on a plant is they're under drought stress. And right now, a lot of our plants in the landscape are under drought stress. We tend to think that because of all the heavy rains we had this spring that everything should be set for the summer. But right now, we're dry again. And when plants are under that drought stress, they're very inviting to spider mites. So one of the ways you can start to reduce that mite population is making an unfavorable environment for them by watering them. If you want to try to check for them and verify that you have them, you could kind of do a smear test, and that's by taking a white sheet of paper and putting that under the branches and tapping those branches over that paper. And then you can take your hand and smear it. If you have
schmear, I love that. That's a scientific word, isn't it?
Kind of like a schmear on a bagel there. Yeah. Schmear it. If you have green streaks, that means you have spider mites. They're eating that plant material.
Okay.
So
is that?
Yeah, I was going to say, how does he address that if he does have spider mites? And, knowing that he's hesitant to use synthetic chemicals.
Sure. Well, you know, like I said, definitely give him watering, but. Also call a company such as The Care of Trees. There are options out there instead of using synthetic pesticides, things that are organic pesticides that you can use. That way you have a low impact to the environment.
Now, will The Care of Trees be able, let's say somebody says, I'd rather not have the full arsenal. I'd like to go organic. Will you guys use those options?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And that's part of the whole questioning process with the customer, mm-hmm. is find out, do they have sensitivity to using specific.
So there you go. That's the way to go. Yes,
Jack. Just another real quick thing. Are these at the stage, how concerned? I mean, the trees are still really green, and there are some spots that I do see that there are brown. Is that, are these things that are going to be dying here, or is this going to be a lost cause? I mean, I know it's hard to tell just based off of that.
But. Sure. Well, in the summer months, the spider mites in particular that feed on arborvitae, they kind of hang low or go dormant during the summer months. So a lot of the browning you're seeing is from feeding activity in the spring. We typically like to target those particular mites in early spring and in fall.
Oh, okay.
All right, I'm gonna try to see how many we can get in here. Thanks for calling, Jack. Here's a question before we do a quick break, and it's from John. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Are you talking about the emerald ash borer?
Yes, I am.
He wants to know if they. You ask a question. Go ahead, John.
Well, it's a flying insect to begin with.
Correct.
All right, and then does it lay eggs?
It does lay eggs.
Now, is that still going to be embedded in the tree when they grind it up? And naturally, some of the eggs are going to survive, aren't they?
You know, once you've ground up that tree, you've disturbed those eggs, they no longer really have a food source. They're not able to develop. So that's why grinding wood chips is a great option for getting rid of that debris.
Yeah, because I'm kind of wondering if they, just per se, did survive.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't they be able to go somewhere else?
The likelihood of them surviving is very, very low.
Well, I'm kind of wondering why they just don't do a study and figure out what type of chemicals can kill them, or, organic stuff.
Sure.
Because, they fly, and even up north where I've got property, I've got some sort of bug that's killing all my pine trees.
Sure. Well, with the emerald ash borer, the biggest means that this pest gets around is transport of firewood. People cut down a tree not realizing it's infested. They transport it to their vacation property, and that's how we get these new areas of infestations.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just chipping that debris, there is not a concern there of spreading that pest.
Mm. Okay.
All right, John, thank you so much. Good question. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
That is David Horvath from The Care of Trees. He's a certified arborist. If you want them to come out, they are, of course, a Davey company. Call 800-508-9466, 800-508-9466 for a free consultation. Let's see if we can get a couple more questions in here. We'll come right back and do that on the Mike Novak Show.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I want your green, natural health or wellness business to be part of the leading sustainability resource in the country. Each month, Natural Awakening Chicago is packed with information our readers use to find the products and services they need to live happier, healthier lives. Natural Awakenings is free each month throughout the city and suburbs and online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more. Hi, my name is Peggy, and I publish Chicago's only local magazine that provides the latest news and trends about healthful living, including alternative and complementary medicine, fitness, good food and drink, healthy kids and families, and even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings is free and available each month throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Allergies acting up, trouble breathing, headaches, sinus pressure, you're tired, congested. Isn't it time to feel better? Breathe deeply and easily. Get rid of the symptoms that complicate your life. Dr. Bonnie Flaster is an acupuncturist and chiropractor who helps people get rid of allergies without using drugs, shots, or needles. Call Dr. Flaster at River North Wellness Center, 312-642-7545, or go to rivernorthwellness.com to find out how to get your body feeling better so you can enjoy life again.
I think we can squeeze in just one more question. Let us go to Donna. Donna, what is your question?
Okay, I don't know how quickly this can be resolved, but I have a dwarf Bartlett pear we bought a few years ago. Thought, of course, you plant it and let it go, and it's gorgeous, but it is overgrown. The limbs are really drooping now, and I've got some very heavy pears all over it.
Wow.
Do I wait until the fall? Or,
you got
do I get rid of these pears so it's not so weighted down?
David's got an answer, and I'm going to let you go, but thank you for calling. You got about 30 seconds, David.
Okay. One of the things you could definitely do is take a stepladder or have a company come out, such as the Carrot Trees, and selectively thin out some of that fruit on there if you're worried about all that excess weight breaking during a windstorm or a rainstorm. Mm-hmm. That would be a very good idea just to minimize the possibility of you losing branches on that tree.
And you guys do fruit pruning?
Absolutely. We do fruit pruning.
I wasn't even aware of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right. David Horbeck, thanks. You guys do it all, and I appreciate that. The Care of Trees, go to thecareoftrees.com or call 800-508-9466. Thank you so much for coming into the studio. Carol and Sarah, that's it, folks. As always, at the end of the show, I think Carol's busy, but you can say it with me. Go green or...
Go home.